everybody, and welcome to our first episode of the Watch Hung Booksellers podcast. We are so glad you are here with us for our launch on Independent Bookstore Day. I'm Catherine Council, and I am the events director at Watch Hung Booksellers, and I'm here today with bookseller Marnie Jessup.
Hi there. Just a quick background for anybody who doesn't know us. Watch Hung Booksellers is an independent bookstore in Montclair, New Jersey, and we're just outside of New York City.
And one of the many great things about our suburb is that it is filled with authors, journalists, publishing professionals, and avid readers. We hold hundreds of events each year and have access to incredible book people coming through our door. So this podcast aims to bring you what we get to be a part of all the time, conversations with the pros who share a love of books.
Yeah, that's right. And as you know, writing and reading are pretty lonely endeavors, and our store philosophy is that books just get better when they're shared in community. So with this podcast, we hope to share our community with you and also bring you into it. So now let's get to our first guests.
Margot Sage L. is the now former owner of Watch Hung Booksellers. She has been running the store for nearly 30 years and recently passed the helm to her daughter, Maddie. Her commitment to books, social justice, and community has cultivated this little bookstore into a cornerstone of our community.
And with her is Elizabeth Egan, a writer and editor at the New York Times Book Review and the author of A Window Opens. Liz is also a dedicated customer, a true book lover, and an honorary bookseller at Watch Hung Booksellers, and just one of the most delightful people we know. Enjoy the conversation, and we will be back to fill you on what's coming up in the store.
Margot, I'm going to start this conversation by throwing it way back to even before Watch Hung Books.
Oh, okay.
Was but a glimmer in your eye, just to set the scene.
Right.
Tell me about your relationship with reading as a kid.
You know, it's so interesting. I was thinking about that the other day because people come in and there's such a wealth of books that are available now, and we just didn't have that. Mm-hmm. We had a few. I think my parents signed us up for a Book of the Month club, and I got the Holiday Family Adventures, which I think only one other person in my life has ever heard of.
Not the Happy Hollisters?
No, the Happy Hollisters. And I kept those books like forever. Who knows how good they are, but anyway. So yeah, there wasn't this big wealth. I always loved reading. I was kind of an awkward kid, so, you know, it's my way of hiding from the world, but yet being part of the world and learning about it, so.
Where did you grow up?
Outside of Boston.
Okay. It's hard for me to imagine you as an awkward kid.
Yeah.
But I'll buy it. I feel that many readers were born in
yes.
that mold,
yes.
myself included.
Yes.
Okay, so you're an adult. You're living in Montclair, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. You were working in textbooks? Publishing,
yeah, textbook
is that correct?
Development, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when did the idea for Watch Hung Books enter your mind?
Exactly. But I know it was hard when my third child was born in 92 here in Montclair. The other two were from Brooklyn. I realized I didn't have, and we have an interracial family. So I realized I was really having trouble finding books. I mean, back then you had no representation of diversity. I just couldn't find any, or I had to go to specialty stores. There were a handful of Black-owned stores back then, which sadly have not survived. So I would buy up whatever I could for the kids. And then I thought to and there was this catalog, China Berry catalog, which was so beautiful. And they had incredible reviews. They were really heartfelt, they had old and new books. So it was such an education. There was no books with children of color at all. And so at one point I called them and I said, I love your catalog, but there are no books for children of color. And they said, well, if that's important to you, you do it.
Even in the Scholastic book fairs, in those circulars?
No, my kids weren't in school.
They were
in school, but kindergarten, yeah.
Yeah.
No, even Scholastic book fairs, barely.
Wow.
You know, Walter Dean Myers and Virginia Hamilton, they were like the representation.
Wow. So you did start a newsletter.
Yeah, so I started a mail order catalog in 1994 as Jeff Bezos was driving across the country to start his online venture. I was like doing the analog and did my own catalog and felt very strongly that I didn't just want a catalog that was just for people of color. I just tried to include everyone and organize it by topic as opposed to race. Because like so many times, I didn't want it to be, I wanted everyone to feel that they were a part of this whole thing.
What was it called?
It was called Great Owl Books.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
And how did you get the word out about it? Like, there was no social media. There was internet.
I bought a mailing list. But we got a Parents' Choice Award, like, really early on. And that was a huge boost. And I don't even know. Then we started getting a lot of buy-in from local people who are school districts and a lot of support that made me think, wow, we need to be a little more locally based. Mm-hmm. So when Watchung Booksellers came up for sale, 95, I bought it finally in 96, but I thought, oh, this is great. I can just move the catalog business into the bookstore, work part-time, raise my children, like, you know, it'll be the perfect.
I love that you thought that you would work part-time as the owner of a bookstore.
There was a lot of naivete.
Well, I do think that people really romanticize
Definitely. The
labor of running a bookstore.
Yeah.
And I think I started off as one of those people, but as a neighbor of the bookstore, walking by with my dog at all hours of the day, there is always somebody in your bookstore. The windows are always lit. When you get off the train at night, no matter what hour it is, the bookstore is a beacon in Watchung Plaza. Where was it back then? I know it wasn't in the same place.
Yeah, no, it was upstairs above Bradner's Pharmacy, what was Bradner's Pharmacy, which in and of itself was this amazing. Did you ever know that?
No, but I remember the store that had some of the fittings of the pharmacy.
Yeah.
I
and now what it's was a, called. It's a frame store now and a Pilates, Pilates studio upstairs. But it was up this really narrow, steep incline, which I don't know how people even got up there. But it was beautifully appointed. As I said, there was a lot of naivete involved in buying the bookstore. But we negotiated. There was a reasonable offer accepted, and we were able to survive. But I think that was in 96 when I bought it, and those were the years that independent bookstores were closing left and right because of the onset of the online bookstore. And we were just so naive. Like, we had $100 days. It's like, wow, each day was better than the last. So we weren't an established store that was destroyed by an online. We just kind of went along with it and survived.
And that was also the era of the mega Barnes & Noble.
Yes.
I remember the excitement of discovering that there was a cafe in Barnes
&
Noble.
Right.
It just felt
idea.
Like Mecca. I knew you weren't supposed to be excited about it. You were supposed to continue to only shop in the small local stores, but secretly I was really drawn to the cafe.
Yeah,
How were you affected by that?
Also not affected because we didn't know what the heck was going on. But it's interesting because other people have brought up that Barnes & Noble democratized book buying because there was always this sense of a bookstore owner being an imperious, you know, looking down their nose at you like you didn't pronounce Proust or Proust correctly. And, you know, you asked for romance novels and not the latest literature. So Barnes & Noble sort of opened up like anyone could come in. Anyone felt comfortable. And that's been brought up in book conferences that we went to in the very beginning. And always stuck with me because that was part of our whole mission, was to have a bookstore that everyone wanted to come into. And so hopefully we weren't that imperious.
No, you were never imperious. It was one of the early things that drew me to the bookstore because I'm not a Proust reader on a regular basis. And I always, from day one, felt that feeling that you could be reading, you know, big fat romance novels or you could be reading sleek vintage paperbacks by somebody whose name I can't pronounce. And you were welcome at Watchung Books. What did Montclair look like in those days?
Oh.
Like, how has the town changed?
I know. I hate that trope that
I know
that Montclair is not what it was.
I know
it. I mean,
I'm already saying it.
Yeah.
I've only lived here for 17 years.
Oh God, so we moved here in '90, and we moved here. There, of course, there were all these, there was this great article in, was it New York Magazine?
Yes. Yeah. I remember it.
That, you know, the utopia, the interracial community. And we were like, oh, wow, this is the place for us to be. But even when we moved here, it wasn't that yet.
I'm from South Orange, okay. So I remember yes. when that article came out. People wow. in South Orange were very bent out of shape because we felt that that was our identity.
Yes. Well, it is. They were similar communities.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But I remember feeling like within five, you know, and we moved from Brooklyn, as mm-hmm. did thousands of other Montclairians. And, you know, there was kind of the shock, like, wow, what is this? The kids loved it. Because they had freedom, they could run around. My husband grew up in the city, so he was very proud that, you know, we had made it to the suburbs. But I was like in shock. Like, I had, you know, who was I going to call on for an emergency? Everyone was really nice, but mm-hmm. then went into their homes mm-hmm. and like shut the doors. So it wasn't stoop living where
right.
you
or playground culture.
Or, yeah, even
you had to you have to make
culture.
Plans.
Yeah.
You have to have play dates.
Yes.
Playmates. Shocking. Shocking.
It was shocking. Yeah. But it did become the town that we wanted it to be.
Yes.
And I always say that the thing that I loved about Montclair is if you could get involved in, you could express a slight interest in anything and you would be immediately the chairperson mm-hmm. of that. And
but much to your chagrin.
Yes, much to your chagrin.
Or mine, at least.
But it, like... It is a community in the sense that everyone gets involved. I don't know many towns like that.
Yes.
You know, they have lovely homes and neighborhoods, and yes, that's fine. But here you really belong to a lot larger people. And I'm hoping that continues. You know, the problem, I think, once your kids are out of the school system, you're less connected that way. I'm really grateful to be at the bookstore because I still feel that connection.
And do you still feel people's very strong connection to the bookstore? I mean, I think it's an organizing principle of our town.
Oh,
I always describe
you.
It as that's... like, I don't belong to a church or a temple. I belong to Watchung Books.
God, that's really great. No, I do acknowledge that we are an important part of the town, but I think that's because we're champions of the town as well, and its people and its authors.
Yes.
So I feel very supported.
When did you move the location above the pharmacy to the corner you're on now?
2 weeks before 9/11.
I know. See, I actually knew the answer to
yeah.
that question, but speaking of
yeah.
our community, can you talk a little bit about that day?
Yes, I was sitting... I had a little weird little office that was built into the store, and we were just trying to organize to get things ready, and there was a workman putting the doorstep in or something, and he looked up and he said, oh, that's weird, a plane just, you know, flew into the World Trade Center. I'm like, what? And of course, then we listened to the radio, but what always got me was, first of all, also the kids from the high school, like, were let out. Like, kids were just, you know, walking around the town. But then when people started coming back,
mm-hmm.
and they were all covered in white dust, whether they made it in or not, like, some people were on the boats. And I always say, thank God, I don't think Montclair had as many casualties as other towns because... Mm-hmm. It was, what wasn't it, the second day of school or
I think so.
Something like that. And, you know, parents were still going in late because they were bringing their kids to school. And, you know, Montclair was fine. Montclair is much more, we were much more casual. We didn't have as many people who, you know, were sitting at their desk at 7
right.
o'clock in the morning. But,
right.
yeah, that was amazing. And also it was amazing for us. I mean, we hadn't even opened the doors yet. But the difference from being upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
like half a block away, and downstairs in the aftermath of 9/11 was that people came in looking for atlases because no one knew
wow.
where Afghanistan was,
wow.
and they wanted mysteries. Like, forget our deep, heavy literature that people used to buy stacks of. No, they wanted escapism. They
yes.
did not want to. So that was the first lesson I think we had in terms of pivoting and readjusting,
mm-hmm.
like, this is not, you know, you can start a business and say this is how I want to run it, but you have to be responsive to everyone who's around.
And things
and what they want.
So far out of your control.
Yeah.
It's really unimaginable.
Yeah.
Moving to another huge crisis, and I promise I won't
yeah,
dwell
not have a crisis
on all the sad things. But speaking of pivoting, let's talk about where you were 4 years ago at this point, 4 years and change on the eve of the pandemic when it started to become clear that you would not be able to keep the doors open.
Yeah.
How did you reassess and strategize and plan?
Well, I knew that I think it was a decree from the governor,
yes,
right?
That's true.
Like, yeah,
yes.
That we had to shut businesses.
Yep. Your store was the last place I went.
Okay.
Actually, no, that's not true. I went to the bookstore, and then, of course, I went and got my hair colored. And then I went into deep quarantine.
The last, yeah.
Yes, wow. Those were my priorities. I've said it out loud.
So I remember there was a Friday. It was Friday the 13th, mm-hmm. right? Then, like, the schools, all of a sudden, everything was shutting down. I have to say, I was in
panicked.
Disbelief.
Yeah.
No, you know, like, what are people talking about? And then when the decree came from the governor that we were supposed to close down, I figured, okay, 6 weeks, right? That's, like, how long it'll take. But I also knew if we could not shut the doors. I mean, mm-hmm. we could not stop the business because I still had to pay rent. I was trying to, you know, pay employees. Of mm-hmm. course, a lot of people left because of health reasons or parenting
right.
responsibilities. And I don't know. I don't know what the thought was, but the one thing that kept us going was that we already had an online, mm-hmm. An imperfect but online presence, which used to be 0.01% of our business. We woke up, there were hundreds of orders every morning from people like we didn't know because that was, you know, libraries were shut. And then Amazon decided books were not essential. And here we were, you know, in this community. And parents were frantic because, you know, they were getting worksheets for their kids. And I think a lot of people just said, you know, I don't care what you do, just read. We were like literally slinging books and then turned the bookstore into a warehouse. Mm-hmm. And there were four of us who like were able to stay in there, and yeah, it was insane.
And then you put the books at the back of the store and people could pick them up.
Yeah, I don't know how we even thought of that.
Well, I will tell you one thing, and I'm probably going to cry when I tell you this, but for 2 weeks, of course, we were in, you know, deep quarantine for months, but for 2 weeks, we went nowhere. After 2 weeks, we ordered a bunch of books and puzzles online, and we emerged from our house, like, you know, blinking heavily like moles, and we walked over to the bookstore, and we picked up, it was my whole family, there are five people in my family, and we picked up our bag of jigsaw puzzles, which, by the way, we never did. We still hate jigsaw puzzles. And in the bottom of the bag were five Werther's caramels. And it was like whoever took our order online knew that we were a family of five and that we always helped ourselves liberally to the real life bowl of candy next to the cash register. And to know, to feel so seen in that moment where we hadn't seen anyone but each other.
That was great.
It was incredibly moving. So you went along like that for how long before you actually opened the doors to customers?
At minimum 4 months, but could it have been 6 months? And then for quite a while we were opening, like, remember we only let five people in at a time and had appointment. It was weird. But wait a minute. But I was going to say it was during the time when we were quarantined, and amazingly, you know, there were four of us who worked in the bookstore. It was, and we were just, it was just taking orders, filling bags. You know, yes, we were grateful that we had the work, but I sat there and go, this is not what we went into bookselling for.
No.
It was the like lack of human contact was horrifying. And also in terms of books for the authors, what we were getting were orders from, like, I don't know, the top, we sold hundreds of maybe the top 10 like commercial books, the books that got written up somewhere. And the rest, like all these beautiful new books that we used to be able to introduce people to and hand to them, were just going by the wayside. It was just the saddest thing about
heartbreaking.
Yeah, about the state of publishing and
several of the authors who had brand new books come out at the beginning of the pandemic have new books out this season.
Oh, that's
or last season. And I, as a reviewer, I've kind of kept a special eye out for those books because those authors, to have the guts to sit down and do it again, especially the debut novelists, and, you know, that's just,
that
your book
amazing.
Came out to nothing.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
How did you, I'm curious, as a boss, how was it interacting with employees? Like, you had to be those four people that you were with in the building, you were all connected the same way nobody else wanted to be connected.
Right.
How did you navigate that?
We cried a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
and I don't, but it was an amazing camaraderie among between the four of us. It was Carolyn, Asia, and Emma, and I, and of course Carlo at DePepo. He was also frantically trying to stay alive, and yet every lunchtime he would send over for the four of us this beautiful, you know, homemade soup or his lunch. It was camaraderie, like really tight.
Shifting gears slightly, because we could talk about the pandemic for the entire time. I mean, here's a very official thank you and congratulations for surviving and then expanding, which is a whole other topic. But let's pause for a second and talk generally about how the publishing world has changed since you start. I mean, it's a big question, but what's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, we only have five publishers.
Well, that's that would be one thing.
And one has about, I don't know, 80% of the business.
Right.
So I feel like there's some good change happening. Like there are independent publishers coming up. You know, of course they don't get their full due or publicity or readership, but I think that the one thing that has struck me over the years is that it is a business where, you know, you can have publicity, you can have a plan, a PR plan for a book, launch it very carefully. But you know what? If people don't like that book, they're not going to buy it. And I've seen this happen with books that had, you know, big to-do that first week, great sales, nothing after that.
Right.
And then yet
it's like a birth plan.
Yeah, it's a birth plan.
It actually means very little.
Like, yeah. And then, but the books where that truly, it's truly a word of mouth business.
Yes.
And, you know, where people are handing books to each other, or a book group gets together and says, wow, let's, you know, read this. And so those books that, like, just over the course of time just build up are amazing. And so to me, that I still have a lot of faith in that, that it's human driven as opposed to.
There's a lot of serendipity involved.
And
it's a business.
You are one of the drivers of that, like word of mouth. I mean, as a reviewer, a book reviewer, and I mean, we rely on the New York Times. Like, our community is a New York Times NPR community.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but it is. When I love a book, I will. Yeah. I often feel that I missed my career in a publicity department. When I really love a book, I will go hog wild and get behind it.
Yeah.
And
do you remember that event that you did for us at the bookstore? Was the No Guilt Book Club?
Yes.
We should do
that again someday. Yeah. That was so much fun.
I still have the outline or the letter that you wrote, and it was so great because that was all part, to me, that was all part of making the bookstore part of the community and, like, you know, having everyone feel a part of it. Like, you didn't have to read the most esoteric literature. And you voiced that so well in that evening.
Well, thank you. That was so much fun.
It was a lot of fun.
And how have ebooks factored in?
So ebooks have settled down into a rhythm for now. When they first came out, I remember the year that the device was sold through the online.
Right. You don't say the name.
No. But because they get so much publicity already.
Yes, no need.
But when that device came and so many people bought it, like, you know, it was the perfect Christmas gift and Hanukkah gift. It's like you knew it was almost $500. So it was a significant.
What?
Yes.
It
when
was?
They first. Yep. When it first came out. It was a significant, like, acknowledging that your spouse is a big reader kind of gift. Very thoughtful. Right?
It was the iPad of its time,
I guess. And I remember thinking that January, January sales are always slow, but it book sales plummeted so quickly that I thought, oh my God, I thought, you know, I spent 27 years waiting for the shoe to drop and I'd have to close the store. So we kept going. But I remember saying to myself, wow, I thought we'd just kind of die a slow death, but this is kind of immediate.
Wow.
And we limped along. But then starting in April, people would come in and say, you know, I don't know where I am. I don't know who's written this book.
Right.
I need to have a physical book.
It has a funny smell.
Yeah.
Like at least the early one.
Yeah.
It did. It had a weird clinical smell to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So people came back.
Yeah. So people came back. And now, so there are certain genres that do lend themselves more to reading online or not online or whatever you want to call it. Mysteries and romance.
Yeah.
Because those are very consumable.
Book a day.
Yeah.
Kind
book
of,
a day kind of people. So of course. And that, you know, and then after that, you know, people seem to have a hybrid approach, like maybe if they're traveling or whatever. But for the most part, they want to have the physical book in their hand. It took a while, but again, like somehow we survived. We had a couple of slow years, but.
I wonder if you had been fully on your feet as a bookseller when Barnes & Noble opened those mega stores, if the arrival of the device would have just seemed like the arrival of another mega bookstore down the road.
Death knell.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I think, though, at that point, we had already had some major glitches, you know, the 2008.
Right.
You know, and somehow every time we were small enough that we were able to, you know, turn around and pivot. It's like, oh, this is what you want? Okay, fine. We'll get this in. Luckily, it's always been within the realm of what we believed in, the you know, the kinds of books, the sense of community. So we always were happy to move forward and happy to make that change.
We touched on the idea that people really romanticize the life of the bookstore owner or the bookstore employee.
Yeah.
I'm sure that you frequently hear from people who tell you that they would like to open a bookstore too.
Yes.
How would you answer that question today?
I actually talk a lot with people about owning a bookstore elsewhere, hopefully.
Because you also, I know you're not going to say this because you're very modest, you also play a very big role in the community of booksellers across the country, which I know well.
Yeah.
And it makes me proud.
You. Yeah. No, it's nice. I mean, look, we benefit from this being a very literary town. Like I always say, you know, half the New York Times lives here. We have major publishers, I think, represented, right, all across the board who are our friends, our customers, and all. So we have, you know, gotten a lot of support, but we've worked hard within the community and in the larger bookselling community. So I've been on the board of the regional booksellers. I, you know, been very involved in the national bookselling. So I appreciate that.
So you are a logical person for people to come to with that question.
And also I like talking to people. So I don't know. I mean, you know, yes, sometimes I'm very busy and I can't. But for the most part, I like talking about the business because it helps me sort out in my own mind what works and what doesn't work for us. You know, it's kind of like a little therapy session.
Right.
So, and
you know I've taken advantage of that myself many times.
But I just was on the phone with someone else who wanted to open a store up in outside of Burlington, Vermont. So it was really interesting talking to him about the demographics, the size of the store, what he envisioned. And this was a person who was not a pie in the sky. I love to read. I just want to own books.
Those are not the people who should own a bookstore. They should volunteer in the library.
Yes. Years ago, somebody said, what's the best profile for a bookseller? Like, you know, is it a major reader? Is it this? And somebody said, no, it's a waitress, like someone who can go, it's like, hi, hen, I'll be right with you. Oh, yeah, you want this? Oh, I know you like your coffee this way. And that's like,
that's so funny.
Yeah. And that's what really, of course, you have to read
because
that's what you're selling. But it is, that's what I love about our booksellers is that they, you know, they know who comes in. They know what their book is. They know what to recommend. When we do our buying seasonally, I sometimes get one copy of a book because I know that one customer who will want that. And
you're thinking of that one customer.
Yeah, thinking of that customer. And then there are other books you look at and say, you know, this is what we should all be reading. So
right.
Let's, you know.
The sort of spinach of yes. the list. You've had lots of people working at the bookstore for many, many years.
Yeah.
But you also have younger people who come yeah. through, you know, you have your high school program. Yeah. How do you find people who really know what they're doing? Like, I would actually rather at this point talk to some of the younger people than even you, believe it or not, when I go in.
Well,
because I love hearing what they're reading.
They're
and they really know their stuff.
Yes, they're great readers. And they read, they would read books that I don't, you know, have the inclination to read. Or and we have great, we also talk about books among ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I feel like, okay, you've read that, you've explained that to me. At least I have a sense of what the book is. But yeah, we've got great young people.
How do you find them?
Some of it must be self-selecting.
Yeah.
You know, like who would apply at a bookstore?
Everyone.
Well, not everyone.
Everyone. Every sentient human being, as far as I'm concerned, should apply in the bookstore. But
salaries are one deterrent.
That's very true.
Yeah. So, you know, we can only afford to pay so much. So it really... I think it really does have to be someone who loves books.
Right.
And loves to talk to people.
Tell me a little bit about how you work with authors in the community, because you have an unusually high number of authors as part of your congregation, so to speak. And I'm sure that can be a lot of fun, and I'm sure that can also be a little bit tricky.
Well, it's a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, like, I used to know every single author in town, and now books come, I mean, we have so many. We have over 100 published authors in town, and this is, like, traditionally published, not, you know, self-published or poetry chapbooks, which, of course, there are also a lot of passionate people in town. But so now I don't have a handle, but for the most part, authors come in and introduce themselves, or as I'm going through all the catalogs, the reps will point out that someone's from Montclair or the area. So what is the response? Well, in the very beginning when we opened up, and I always thought that if we cannot champion our own authors, if we can't celebrate them and have a party or, you know, an event for them, where, you know, back in the days, I guess Barnes & Noble was doing more events, but you couldn't get in unless you were an A-list author. So here I just said, you know what, these are our people and we'll always support them. But when we started in 96, we had less than 10 authors in town. It was like Valerie Wilson Wesley, Sharon Dennis Wyeth, John Katz, Neil Baldwin. That was it. And now we have so many.
I wonder how many of them moved here knowing that your bookstore is here.
One person did say to me, she goes, you know, I was coming, you know, can I leave Brooklyn? Can I survive in, you know, Montclair? And she said, and then I looked at we had a list, which we have to update, a list of Montclair literati on our website. And she looked at it and she said, oh, if these people can live here, so can I. So, and I know people have said that they moved here because they knew there was a bookstore.
Well, I am definitely one of them. But I always wonder how many conversations you've had with people who have New York license plates. You know, their car is still running outside.
Yep.
How many conversations you've had with the tortured person wondering, can they survive in the suburbs? I feel like you and Raymond are the two people that probably feel that conversation the most. Let's talk a little bit about the future of the bookstore.
Okay.
Because you have just welcomed your daughter into the fold. I'm sure it's been in the works for a long time.
Yep.
And I kind of wish she was here. You should have a whole separate podcast.
Yes, I think she deserves it.
Yeah, for sure. When did the two of you start talking about the next phase?
So it was post-pandemic for...
Okay.
Not directly. Well, when did the pandemic end? You know,
right.
But it was... Maddie was a principal in New York City, two young children here in Montclair. And being a high school principal was kind of brutal during the pandemic. And commuting with two little kids was also, like, insane. And I had no idea that she wanted to come into this store. I mean, she always said, I'm going to be a principal, a lawyer, and run the bookstore. I'm like, you know what, Maddie? It's not a part-time job.
And but, she had worked in the bookstore before. Oh, yeah. Had all of your kids worked in the bookstore at some point?
In one way or another. Yeah, yeah. Or as Maddie said, I worked here at 9 years old and was not paid.
They volunteered in the bookstore.
They volunteered. And I also recognized that I was not moving forward. Like, there was so much emphasis to get us back on track after that. I felt the air was just knocked out of me. And I was always one for coming up with new plans, new directions. Every year we would have a great staff meeting where we would just kind of talk about, whither the bookstore. And those were really driving principles to make changes. But it wasn't happening. So when Maddie started talking about coming on and taking over the bookstore, it was great. And she brought the energy she wanted to open the children's store. She had the energy, the vision, the wherewithal to do all that. So,
and just as being a waitress is excellent preparation to work in a bookstore, probably being a school principal is even better.
Yeah. Well, because she's a devoted educator, and so that, carries through. And, she has a whole different way of looking at kids' books, whereas mine was much more, emotional and romantic. She also understands the fundamentals behind reading and all that. So it's very exciting. And she's got a whole new crew of people who are, moving forward with this mission. She is expanding the book fairs and, all that stuff that takes a lot of work.
And embedding your bookstore and your family even deeper into the community.
Oh.
I would say.
Yeah.
When you walk into the kids' room, even if you walk by and look at what's in the window, do you think back to the days when you were looking at book offerings for children and they were only offering books about one type of kid?
Yeah.
Because the world has changed in that way for the better.
Yes. And publishing is much more responsive. More authors and illustrators are coming on. The editorial boards have changed. I mean, it has changed. But no, I didn't think of that. I do remember walking into a bookstore once and somebody said, oh, here are all the children's books, and here's the shelf of diverse books. I'm like, what?
When you go into the grocery store and there's a shelf of international foods that has, Tabasco sauce or something on it. Like, really?
So
this couldn't be integrated?
Yeah. And now everything is everything. So
yes, as it should be.
Yeah.
I know it's hard. You don't have a crystal ball, but what do you see as the next big publishing trend? I know, but you have had a front row seat for all these years.
Yeah.
Where is the publishing industry going? I mean, the publishing industry is always sounding its own death knell. That's just having now crazily worked in this field for 30 years, I've heard 100 times.
Right.
It's not how it used to be. It's, things are changing. It won't be like the old days. And I've kind of learned to tune that out. That, books still keep coming out. People still keep reading them.
Yeah.
There are always the crazy outliers and then the quiet chuggers along. What interests you on the horizon?
Wow. I've not given that much thought. But one thing I think is I think there are way too many books being published.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand there are niche markets. And, I am curious, what it would be like to be within publishing and how they work. Like, when an original book gets published, if someone's taken a chance on it and it gets published and it takes off, then why all of a sudden, within the year, are there 20 more books just like it?
Well, one of my abiding memories of the night of the No Guilt Book Club at your bookstore, it was the first time I saw 50 Shades of Grey. It was on one of the tables in the middle of the store.
Yeah.
And everyone was talking about it. And I had never heard of it.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's a funny trend. And
yeah.
Then probably 10 months later, I was standing in the same spot. And there were 10 knockoffs of 50 Shades of Grey.
Yes.
I always wonder what is the book that, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people wonder this, but like, what is the book that hasn't been written? We spend so much time talking about how to make a Frankenstein of, you know, all the things that people like. What is the thing that people want to read but haven't read?
But I think what we've seen over time is that it doesn't have to be what people want to read. Like,
yes.
Like, remember when Seabiscuit came out?
Yes.
I'm like, oh, who wants to read about a horse? I'll get one copy for a friend who I know bets on horses.
Yes.
You know, and yet, but so it's...
Those are the best books.
Yes, those are the best
books. The Kismet books.
It's not, it's, yeah, the Kismet books. That's a great
Yeah, I always think of it as... The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks.
Yes.
I'm kind of dating myself, but I always say this. I remember when I first heard of that book, I was like, nobody's going to read a book about jeans with a G.
Yeah.
I would definitely read a book about jeans with a J.
Yeah.
And guess what? Everybody read that book.
I know.
And I think about it every single day, and it came out years ago.
So to me, it's more, it's the art of writing.
Yes.
The authenticity, not necessarily of the subject, although it's always exciting to have like a new subject. You know, people have put their heart and soul and passion into a book. I feel like that's what we're all responding to with the books that we love, the books that we press into someone else's hands.
Are you always aware of that every day when you walk into the store, that you're treading on people's dreams? You know, every book you buy or don't buy, every book you sell or don't sell, every spine on your shelf is someone's dream.
Yes.
Somebody's quiet morning for years on end, toiling. It's a very lonely way to work.
Yeah.
To be a writer.
And if a book doesn't sell, like we return it to the publisher, I feel awful returning it. I feel like I did not give this person a chance, this writer. But, you know, in the end, we are a business. I have to pay the rent and I have to pay employees and I have to pay the publishers. So I can't, you know, so that's, it's...
The fact that you've been at it for this long and have not become jaded and just thought, like, next, bring in the spring books. that's a tribute to you, Margo.
Oh, thanks.
What are you... this is my least favorite question when people ask me this, but I'm going to ask you anyway. What is the book that excites you the most right now?
Well, I'm just finishing up the King Solver's Demon.
Oh, good.
Which
good. Yeah.
I know it's like had its, you know, all its publicity, but it is
well deserved.
It's such an amazing book. But then the other, so in terms of new books coming out, Maddie just gave me the galley for Percival Everett's new book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, James, which is a retelling of Through the Eyes of James with Huck Finn.
Wow.
And, so that's fascinating. And then I've got all these galleys for author events coming up that we're very excited about. So the pile next to my bed keeps getting larger.
It's formidable, I'm sure. Are you always thinking 6 months ahead? Like when somebody asks me for a book recommendation, I have a book recommendation for a book coming out in July.
Yeah.
But I don't have one for a book that came out on Tuesday.
Right, which is one reason why I know the publishers want us to read the galleys early so we can start, you know, getting the word out. But if I love a book, I want to be able to walk in the next day and actually hand it to someone. So it's very hard for me to read 6 months in advance. I can look forward to something, but
is it frustrating?
I read more immediately.
We always at the Book Review wonder how frustrating it is for readers and booksellers when we publish a review for a book that won't come out for 10 days.
Yeah, but wasn't that started because of our internet purveyor?
You know, I don't have an answer to that.
Okay.
Sometimes it's a matter of what fits in print.
That's interesting.
There are a bunch of reasons. Yeah. I think it's probably better for the author.
Yeah.
If the review comes, if it's a positive review, if it comes out before their publication date, because then they get more pre-orders, maybe?
Yeah. I think people have been trained to do that.
Yes.
Initially, people, I remember, was it just a few years ago? I feel like there was a change because you got the review and you knew the book was in the store. But now it could be a whole week.
If I read like a civilian, I would be so incredibly annoyed that I had to wait a week for the book to come out.
But I think, as I said, I think we've all become trained.
Yes. I apologize for my role in that.
No.
What keeps you, I promise I don't have too many more questions, but what keeps you up at night when you're thinking about the bookstore?
Like the orders I've forgotten to place. We do a lot of off-site events with organizations in town, which are hugely important to us. So I'm always a little worried that I've got all that covered.
Mm-hmm.
And
how do you keep track of it all? Are you a paper person?
Isn't that a big problem?
Do you have an app that you track everything on?
No. I am a paper person, but then I seem to lose the scraps of paper that I write my notes on. So I think I rely very heavily on fabulous staff, and Maddie has a much more nimble brain than mine at this point. So
you're lucky to have her.
Yeah.
Okay, this is really my final question. Imagine you are Margot circa, was it 1992? Standing at the bottom of the steps of the old bookstore.
Right.
Ready to walk upstairs for your first day above the pharmacy as the owner of this bookstore. What would you say to her?
Wow. I think what I would say is kind of what I did, which is just one foot in front of the other. Just keep doing it. Doing what you love will make it happen is not necessarily true, as we all realize, but somehow it's worked. It's worked here. I've got the support of family. I've got the support of a community. I know there are quite a few people who said, you're crazy. Why are you doing this? You know, a bookstore on the second floor, a bookstore, you know, it's like, I just did it. I don't know. It just kept working. And for that, I'm really grateful.
I would say to you, you did it. And for so many people, you offered a home in this town before this town felt like home. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll leave it right there.
Thank you.
Thanks, Margot.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you, Margot and Liz, for the great conversation. We loved hearing about the history of Watchung Booksellers. And we're especially grateful to both of you for all you do to support books.
And for you listeners, we hope you take some time today to visit us. Or if you aren't local, visit your own indie bookstore on Independent Bookstore Day. We love to celebrate today with our customers who keep us going. Also today is the beginning of Succeed Together's Montclair Literary Festival. There are events all day long at Montclair State University, and most of them are free. And ticketed events are happening all throughout the week. And then next Saturday, on May 4th, there's another full slate of author talks in downtown Montclair. And you can find out about the festival and all of our upcoming events in our show notes and also at watchungbooksellers.com.
Recording and editing at Silverstream Studio. Original music is composed and performed by Violet Mujica. And thanks to all the staff at Watchung Booksellers and the Kids Room for their hard work and love of books.
And thank you for listening. If you enjoyed it, please like and subscribe and follow us on social media at Watchung Booksellers. And if you have any questions, you can reach us at wbpodcast@watchungbooksellers.com.
Join us in a couple of weeks for conversations with Dionne Ford and Alice Elliott Dark. Until then, for the love of books, keep reading. Thank you.